that I'm seeing around me, the society that I'm seeing, the universe entirely. So we all have seen some of those dark experiences. We want to talk about those darknesses that might happen in life and the moments that plague us. I want you to give us some examples of those dark experiences, those dark moments that have given you something to think more about life. Because, you know, through those dark hours of life, we get to ponder deeper into our life, into our souls, into society, other people, humanity in general.
The first thing that comes to my mind is this darkness of lack of being grateful towards the blessings that you
in
have.
Ingratitude.
Yeah, living in gratitude, because I'm studying different cases of diseases and different stories of different people that they didn't imagine they would actually be, for example, afflicted with this disease one day. This incurable one, like cancer, like, I don't know, being paralyzed. These stories really tell me that there is this darkness, there is this potential darkness over your life at every moment. And if you are healthy, if you have your mother, you have your father, you have your beautiful family, it's not something to be taken for granted.
Exactly.
It is something for you to be grateful.
Yeah, and whenever, just speaking of the diseases that you were just mentioning, whenever I see a blind person and enjoying life and then saying that, okay, I have a lot of things to be grateful for, I feel ashamed of myself.
Exactly.
And not just those blind people. There are people who are suffering from poverty, but at the same time, when you go into their houses, they're living an honorable life in a way that, again, you feel so ashamed of yourself for all the facilities that you have.
Yeah.
And you feel like life is to be taken for granted, that life is not a chance to be seized up, is not a chance to enjoy, to be enjoyed with all its problems and difficulties.
Interestingly enough, I saw a YouTube clip recently where there was somebody who was just kind of like going around interviewing just people on the street. And the more, like, the more affluent the person who they were interviewing seemed, the more they were complaining about, you know, no, the weather is bad, the business is bad, money is bad, everything's bad. And from their appearance, like from the clothes they were wearing, the watch they were wearing, the shoes they were wearing, it was obvious that they were actually pretty well off. And then the same person went and interviewed people, like somebody was selling, like, veggies in a cart. Somebody was selling, like, was cleaning shoes.
Yeah, random people, like ordinary common people.
And the, like, in appearances, the less affluent the individual they were interviewing were, the more grateful that person was. They would say, alhamdulillah, money is good, business is good, life is going by, the weather is good, family's healthy.
What's the reason, according to you? I always wonder, really, why? Because I have came to the same conclusion, like, those people who are wealthier, the people who are healthier, the people who have more of things to be grateful for, usually have a lot of things to complain about.
I think it's because they take it for granted, because they think these are things that just exist in life. They should have them. It's like a default. And so they don't even look at the things they have. They keep looking at the things that other people who have these things also have. So it just leads to them just, you know, obviously being unhappy and being like, well, look, if I make this much money in a month and I can, like, go on, like, 10 trips a month, there's that other person who can go on, like, 20 cruises
a
month.
Exactly, yeah. And that goes back to the greed of human beings.
Yeah, yeah. And the more somebody has dealt with the daily needs of life, you know, providing for food, providing for clothes, the more that person sees the miracles of life that, look, this doesn't always exist.
They're more
considerate. Out of thin air. Yeah. And there is a provider who's providing these things. It's a miracle that I have these things, even though, like, you know, I face so much difficulties. I'm not facing these other difficulties. Because they're living on, you know, like, as, like, somebody who's dealing with the basic needs of life every day, they are more aware of it.
So I would put it this way, that not necessarily if you're wealthy or well off, it's the case that you are going to have a good spiritual life.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that way. I have said it many times, and there are many examples of that. When they say that being wealthy does not necessarily lead to a healthy mental lifestyle, I do agree with it, because many times those people who are just so wealthy, so healthy, so they have everything, but when you dig deep into their soul and when you talk to them, you see how much of a depressed person they are.
Yeah.
And then so, in that point, you just realize that, honestly speaking, it's not the matter of money. It's the matter of satisfaction in your soul. The contentment is a treasure that is not given to every single person. Maybe you are a poor person, but your heart is filled with contentment.
Yeah. And so I think what's really interesting is that in our Islamic law, we have things like called khums, and we have things called zakat. Like, we have something zakat of fitra, which is what we usually pay at the end of the month of Ramadan.
The holy month of Ramadan.
And so it's kind of like a zakat that's meant to basically, it's a show of gratefulness for your health. That,
yeah.
You know, I got through this month of Ramadan.
Exactly.
I was healthy. I fasted. I had food for iftar. I was, you know, able to
so
get through this.
So this concept of gratefulness is so important in our lives. But since we were talking about the darkness of life, we got to gratefulness and to be satisfied and content with our lives. So just imagine how these circle goes on in our mind. It's very noteworthy. So before we get into more of how to debate this darkness of life, how to go through it, let's go for a short break, a change of mood, and then we'll be back in a blink of an eye. Welcome back, Quail. This is Back to Reality. Thank you for joining us. I am Asma. Sister Bita and Sister Zara are helping us with today's discussion, which is about the darkest hours of life. Have we ever seen such hours? I mean, you as listeners also can just share your ideas with us. There's no one who could say no. I have never lived such moments. We all have lived. We all have been through those hours, and
this
we know
life.
How it works.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes out of a sad scene or a happy scene that we go through those darkest hours. As we just mentioned, the idea of those unhealthy people, when we look at them, we go through that dark hour because we compare them to ourselves. We are happy that we're not in their place, and at the same time, we're ashamed of not seizing the day, of not enjoying the moment,
exactly.
Though we're not in their place. Tell us about some more of these examples.
Talking about the darkness of life, I'm going to actually narrate a story for you, which is so dark. One of the darkest things I've ever heard.
Okay.
Which is the
well,
story,
our ears.
Yeah, which is the story of an 8-year-old motorcycle driver who had an accident. And at that accident, he actually, his spinal cord was completely ruined.
Oh my
and,
God.
Yeah, his ability beneath there, his neck was completely lost.
Oh my
and,
God.
And the point is,
like there are some movies like that. We have some movies.
Unfortunately, it is reality.
Yeah.
And the bitter part of this story is that his mother, when she was talking to the family and so on, she was like, thank God he is okay and he's completely healthy, because in his appearance, he was lying in a bed.
Yeah.
And yeah, at that situation, she thought that he is completely healthy and so on. And she was just telling this out of his appearance, but unfortunately, she didn't know the darkness and the depth of this story. And the doctors were like that, how could we even tell her mother that he is unable to move even his hand for the rest of his life? And I mean, this is the depth of darkness of life. Sometimes it's like a joke, it's like a comedy, but
yeah.
It's completely difficult, harsh. and dark.
Yeah, it is. So when we see a catastrophe, like there was an earthquake the previous year, I suppose it was in Turkey, a lot of people were killed. At the same time it was winter, and then a lot of people were killed. But seeing those people, all of those people going through all those traumas is a dark hour for all the people who watch it.
Yeah.
Right now, this year, we have people of Palestine, all these people, all these children, women getting to be killed is another dark hour to think about. Like, we know that there are many individuals in this world who are suffering from loneliness. They don't have anybody around them. This is another dark hour.
I guess the only way you can see a way out of that darkness is just kind of, you know, as we've seen among the people of Palestine, how a lot of them have, like, they're still motivated. They're still,
they still
have their spirits.
Back. Yeah,
and they're like, you know what? They don't give in. God is with us. Yeah. What fear do we have? If he took somebody, he loves them and he will care for them better than I could have.
Yeah.
My, like, a mom who lost her children, a dad who lost two
so
of his
kids. So this thing I learned from dark hours is that even in those dark hours, there is happiness. There is a promise of happiness that would eventually happen. Mm-hmm. A promise of salvation, a promise of prosperity, a promise that everything is going to be right.
And I suppose there is a really dangerous point about darkness, that sometimes when you get used to darkness, you will run away from light. And at those times, you are too lost in the fear of the darkness of your life that you're afraid to go for the light. You're afraid to change everything. And if you're at that state of life, I believe you have to strengthen your connection with Allah Almighty, your
That's
faith.
That's very true.
And put your whole trust in Allah.
Yeah.
He's always there for you, and you won't be disappointed.
Exactly.
That's true, because sometimes people end up, because of one sadness, they end up chasing misery.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, thank you. It was a very fruitful session. I enjoyed it so much. I hope the audience and the listeners have enjoyed it as well. So, this was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, farewell to you guys. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. Before we get to the discussion with the panel, let's review some of the day's developments. A temporary pause on the horizon. U.S. President Joe Biden says apartheid Israel is ready to halt the genocidal war on Gaza for the holy month of Ramadan, as Gaza ceasefire talks continue. British-founded charity Oxfam says Israel is ignoring the International Court of Justice's provision on starvation in Gaza. Meanwhile, more cross-border strikes between Israel and Hezbollah as the Lebanese resistance movement targets an Israeli military base with a barrage of retaliatory rockets. Also, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK on a future Palestinian government that will include all Palestinian factions and the centrality of the anti-war movement in Britain to ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. His words: in less than 5 months, apartheid Israel has killed some 30,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 70,000 others, most of those murdered women and children. Time now to introduce our panel in the studio, theater director and writer Jonathan Chadwick, alongside journalist and author Frank Hughes, who is joining us from the north of Ireland via Skype. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Jonathan. A genocide case and an apartheid case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, filed only a month apart. How isolated are Israel and its staunchest allies, backers, like the US, the UK, and Germany?
Increasingly, I would say. I think it represents a real escalation of their isolation in the world. You don't mean isolated from each other, presumably, because that's also a part of the chemistry that will happen as things start to go badly for Israel and the Americans. They will start to try to depart company, and that's inevitable. You've seen that in US behavior in the past, in other places. But I would say, yeah, I think it's a part of the isolation process, and I think it's only coming just so late to save lives in Palestine. I don't think it's going to mean that the Israelis are going to change course. In fact, the isolation of these entities may intensify the feelings within them of having to pursue the course that they're pursuing in terms of trying to fight their way out or genocide their way out of the situation. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I think it's both, you know, you can cheer the International Court of Justice, and certainly bringing a case about occupation is absolutely right, isn't it? That is the problem, and actually for it to be revealed to be the problem, which you can so easily ignore, that is really, really important to get that actually out in the open.
Tens of submissions that were given at the ICJ on the legality or illegality of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory, some would say they were so good they had to become lectures at the universities for students. Farah, the same question to you. I guess I'm going to rephrase it and ask you what you think is the significance of the fact that there have been two such cases, one genocide brought forth by South Africa, and the other one on occupation or apartheid against Israel at the ICJ.
Well, I think it's the first time in the history of the Israeli state that they have actually been brought to the International Court of Justice and are being held accountable for their crimes against humanity, for the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank, the continued expansionist settlement policies. And I think America and the UK and the EU have all been exposed as being fully complicit in not only the birth of Israel in 1948, but with American help in 1967, they started and they won the Six-Day War, which led to the illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So I think on many levels, we are seeing a turning point in history, in international relations, and in the international perception of the global public of what Israel really is, which is a racist, apartheid, expansionist state. Israel is one of the only countries in the world to refuse to defend its borders. So far from finishing its onslaught on Gaza and the West Bank, if it continues to be held unaccountable, it will continue to expand into other nations, to include Syria and Lebanon and Egypt. So it's important going forward that people see what is really happening on the ground through social media. And in real time, we are watching the genocidal carpet bombing and now the starvation of 2.4 million people.
The ceasefire being mentioned, as I mentioned earlier also, is only temporary. There seems to be no permanent solution thus far, at least as far as now is concerned.
Yes, and in order to end the violence that we're witnessing, all we need is for America and Joe Biden to stop sending money, arms, and giving political cover to the Zionist apartheid regime. The whole idea of this ceasefire really comes down to one thing, and that is the internal pressure that Netanyahu is under from the relatives of the people that are held prisoner in Gaza by the resistance groups. These people are on the streets, tens of thousands of them, demanding an early election, demanding Netanyahu resigns or steps down from government. And what they want is the release of the hostages. So everything we're witnessing and everything we're hearing, including America going from vetoing even the word ceasefire in UN resolutions to accepting it, is purely to allow some form of negotiated settlement to allow the release of the Israelis, many of the members of the IDF that are held in Gaza. They want them out, and then I would imagine that the massacre of Rafah would continue apace as soon as those people are released.
I want to talk about what the Palestinian ambassador had to say, which was the pro-Palestine processions, the marches and rallies that we've seen happen for more than 4 months here in the UK. He called the UK or London the epicenter of international activism for Palestinian liberation. And yet, at the same time, you hear comments from government officials. Recently, MP Lee Anderson saying what people have called Islamophobic against the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, which people say is symptomatic of the deep Islamophobia inside the political party itself. What do you make of that? The divide between how the Palestinian ambassador thinks of these processions and what the government here thinks of these people?
Yeah, I put the epicenter of resistance to the oppression of the Palestinian people close to the Red Sea, personally. I think that it's very, very important, the movement that's happening here, because it is a recognition of an enormous sense of togetherness and solidarity between people here that feel very, very strongly about the Palestinian people and can see within the movement for Palestinian liberation their own struggle. But the British state is heading in a really disastrous direction, and it's been doing so ever since the 2001. This is just the war on terror repeddled, and they're trying to play that tune again and again and again and again, trying to make out that the Muslim population of this country are in some way contiguous with terrorism, contiguous with migrants. This is politics of disaster, and it's disastrous politics. And they're going to end up where other speakers of this sort, who indulge in exclusionary politics, end up in the dustbin of history.
On the ash heap of history. Farah Hughes, I'd like to get your reaction to the same question. The way the government here and perhaps the political establishment altogether have approached or treated the pro-Palestine solidarity campaign that's been ongoing, of course, for decades, but went into overdrive since this genocidal war on Gaza started.
I think we've maybe noticed over the last few years, maybe the last decade, how much the Israeli lobby and how much the parties, both Labour Friends of Israel and the Conservative Friends of Israel, and even if we go slightly farther afield, when we go to America, you see all the presidential candidates going to the Wailing Wall in East Jerusalem. So I think what we have is a coalescence of British politics with Zionist foreign policy and Zionist policy within Gaza. We have seen the British establishment move to the point where they tried to ban Palestinian flags. I was recently at a Palestinian rally here in the north of Ireland, and I was one of the speakers. And the police were there recording everything that was being said by the speakers on the day. Presumably, if someone had said something that could be seen as being anti-Semitic or indeed being seen in favour of the resistance groups, who have the right under international law to resist by all means necessary the illegal occupation of their land and their country. We're witnessing the state and the state establishments moving into an anti-Palestine and a pro-Israeli zone. And a part of that is this encouragement of Islamophobia from Tommy Robinson and people on the right, as far as the Conservative government where they are pushing the narrative where people who are Muslims in this country could be seen as a fifth column working to destabilize the nation. So part of that is an attempt to, I believe, the Zionists have for many, many decades tried to change anti-Semitism into Islamophobia. They are trying to portray the Muslims as the terrorist threat to the world, and that Israel and the Zionist state is not a threat to anybody, but any Muslim anywhere in the world is a potential threat to the country that they live in.
Absolutely. Zionism, the ideology of division, no doubt. Gentlemen, we're fresh out of time. Jonathan Chadwick and Brad Hughes, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Until we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key with Sheikh Rouhani on RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. Dear and respected brothers and sisters, in this series of the episodes of The Key, the program of The Key, we are trying to answer some of the important questions regarding the religious beliefs, particularly regarding the occultation of the Imam al-Asr arwahuna fida. There are many questions regarding his occultation, and of course, different responses are available for these sort of questions. Here today, I wanted to mention this point that sometimes the people might get a bit, what you can say, shocked that, okay, why Imam is hidden for this long time, and why is Imam hidden? Why is there, for example, major occultation? While if you go back to the history, we see that, of course, this sort of occultation or this sort of ghaiba happened, or, for example, the long life for the other people, particularly for some of the prophets, happened before this Imam in the history. So it's not something strange. It is not something very, for example, unbelievable, for example, or unexpected. That is why if we go back to the previous nations, communities before Islam, we see that in the history, lots of things happened. And it comes to the ghaiba of the prophet, the ghaiba of the 12th Imam and also his life, we have to sometimes refer to the previous nations as well. For example, in the history of the Prophet of God, there are instances when for certain reasons, a prophet would be hidden from his, for example, own community or nation. This point is one of the reasons presented to explain the occultation of the Imam of the time. For example, in reply to a question on the wisdom behind the occultation of Hadrat al-Qa'im, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam said that the wisdom behind his occultation is the same wisdom behind the occultation of the proofs of the proofs of Allah or Hujjatullah ta'ala prior to this Imam. For example, in a hadith, Imam al-Sadiq is reported to have said to Hassan ibn Sudayr that it is the divine will that the sunnat of the previous prophets will be applied to the occultation of the Qa'im. Hence, the total periods of time of their occultations shall happen to him. And also, the prophets whose occultations have been mentioned in traditions are Prophet Yunus alayhi salam, Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, Prophet Musa, and Prophet Salih alayhi salatu wasalam. So the cases of the first three prophets are also mentioned in the Holy Quran as well. as the like Prophet Yahya, Prophet Yusuf, and Prophet Musa. So it's not something strange because it happened to the other prophets that they were also hidden from their ummah and their nations for a while. Ibn Abdullah ibn Sanan says that Imam al-Sadiq said that regarding the Qa'im, a precedent of Musa shall happen. I asked that what is that, for example, precedent? The Imam said that the secret nature of his birth and his occultation from his community. As you see that Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam mentions very clearly here that since the other prophets before Prophet of Islam, they were also sometimes hidden from their own nations. So this ghaiba of the prophets, of the Hujjatullah ta'ala, of the proofs of the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's not something strange, it's not something, let's say, unbelievable. That is why it is very much normal and natural that it would happen to the Hujjatullah ta'ala, particularly to the last Hujjah, which is the Imam al-Asr arwahuna fida. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Rouhani in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. In addition to the status of the Ahlul Bayt, in order for us to become true soldiers of the Imam, we decided to take on a heavy task as a community. We decided to relearn our beliefs from the Quran itself, to go over a book together, and to have this be a learning experience. Retraining ourselves, retraining our hearts and souls, isn't easy. It's not always easy to give up something that we've learned from before, a different way of thinking, to embrace it, to learn to think as God wants us to think, to feel as Allah says feel, and to see the world as Allah wants us to see the world. It's not easy. It is something that requires effort, requires willingness, and it even requires dua. So before we begin the book that we're going to be covering, brothers and sisters, there's a very beautiful dua. Again, we're asking Allah to open our hearts so that we can embrace Quran and Sunnah. There are sometimes definitions that we'll find which are different than the way we grew up, what we heard in Sunday school, right? But the idea is to read these things together. So that very beautiful dua is this. We start off with salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Wa arinil haqq. This is from Imam Sadiq. O Allah, show me the truth to be truth. Hatta attabi'ahu. Show me the truth to be truth. So I embrace it. I accept it. I follow it. What else? Wa arinil batil. Batila. Show me falsehood to be falsehood. We're going to come with an open heart and mind. We're going to be reading these verses of the Quran. I'll be pointing out these Quranic stories. And after that, I will be asking brothers and sisters to see, what do we get from these verses? Because we're going to go directly, inshallah, to the Quran. So we're asking that we see batil to be batil, hatta ajtanibahu, so that we can avoid batil and stay away from batil. Now, because we're doing that, then I do have one thing that I'd like to share before we start. Alhamdulillah, remembering the five holy personalities, and because of the birth of our Imam, I don't know how many of you were able, well, those of you who speak Farsi were definitely able to. Some of you would have, I'm sure this it's been translated as well. I don't know how many of us got a chance to see the interview of Qasim Soleimani. There's one last interview that he does where he talks about the 33-day war. Again, let's not forget our principle. The idea is, if you have taqwa, you do your job. There are certain things you can't see. There are certain things you can't plan for. Out of the reach of your aql, God will act as your eyes and ears. Just as an example of this promise. So if brothers and sisters remember, he's explaining the beginning of the 33-day war, and he says that we went in there initially, and our job was just to exercise taqwa. What was our taqwa? We had brothers who were captured by Israel. No way of freeing these prisoners. It was our responsibility. Taqwa meant, go rescue them. So they went into Israel, they got the Hummer, they captured the Israeli soldiers with the idea of, we'll exchange them. They had no idea that Israel had been planning a game-changing war to depopulate Lebanon of the Shia population. They didn't know that. They were trying to do their responsibility. Taqwa of Allah. Because of that, they were ready when Israel responded. But they had no idea. Right? You exercise taqwa, God acts as your eyes and ears. Taqwa, brothers and sisters, is now another verse of the Quran. Taqwa, Quranic taqwa, makes you a giant killer. You're able to move mountains with the help of Allah with taqwa. That first verse that I mentioned to brothers and sisters, there were multiple verses in the Quran that said that. This one also, more than once in the Quran, Allah repeats it. Let's see if I can give you one more example. Surah Baqarah again. So Surah number 2. And brothers and sisters, if the address that I'm giving you is incorrect, please share so that I can correct it. Surah Baqarah and verse number 194. God says this in the Quran. End of the verse. Wa'lamu, know this. Anna Allah, truly Allah, ma'al muttaqeen. God Himself, the Lord of the universe, is on the side and with those who have taqwa. Why is it that you say we can move mountains? Because if I get Quranic, we haven't described what Quranic taqwa is. But if I can have that, God is with me. Wa'alamu, know this, that God is with those who have taqwa. There's another reason why taqwa needed to be discussed before iman. So the book that we're having, brothers and sisters, if you look at it, the book is going to first talk about taqwa. After that, it's going to talk about iman. What is true iman? What are the promises of God for mu'mineen? After that, it'll talk about what is tawheed, then nubuwa, then wilayah, it'll go on, right? To reaffirm our Quranic beliefs. Why is it, question, why is it that the leader would talk about taqwa, right? Fear of God or God-wariness, we have to describe what that is, before he talks about iman? We're talking about, there's a book of faith, right? Aqidah, getting the correct aqidah. Why talk about taqwa first? Another key element to taqwa, and I'm going to show you the verse of the Quran, is that taqwa is, of course, it needs to be there from the beginning of our spiritual journey till the end. But taqwa ensures divine guidance. Taqwa ensures divine guidance. More than that, and I want to share a little bit with you, taqwa is necessary before faith. The leader will explain.
There are some people who have taqwa before they formally become Muslim. The person who has taqwa will become Muslim. What does that mean? Taqwa before iman. Absolutely. How? What's the definition? Right? But if that taqwa can be there, then that also will lead to faith. Okay. So now, what happens is, I didn't share the verse. Let's see if this verse is also correct. We're going to talk about this later. Right? So Surah Baqarah, so it's Surah number 2, and verse number 2. Thalikal Kitab. That is the book, right? The Quran. That is the book. La Raiba Fih. There is no doubt in it. Hudan Lil Muttaqeen. It is a source of guidance for those who have taqwa. Even those who, before Islam, had a level of taqwa, those people will be able to benefit. There are some people, and the Quran's going to describe them. I'm going to give you a Quranic story about some people who find no benefit in the Quran. Who are those people? Who are these people? Quranic stories. Anyhow, now, the way the leader describes taqwa, right, because we're redefining these terms, first he's going to start off by explaining what taqwa is not. We're going to learn a Quranic story, right? What is not taqwa? What's not taqwa?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Ali. حالي حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Midstream.
Last week, the second edition of the Paris meeting took place in the French capital, attended by representatives from Zionist Israel, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, with the aim of solidifying the negotiating framework that will guide the indirect negotiations between the Palestinian resistance Hamas and the Israeli entity. However, after the Israeli entity signed backtracked from what was agreed upon in Paris previously under the direction and pressure of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who prevented his negotiating team from returning to Cairo to continue the talks and had stripped them of their powers, delegating his special advisor instead. This made it clear that no one can trust the commitment of the occupation even to what it and the mediators would agree upon in Paris too. Moreover, it is evident that the U.S. administration exerted strong pressure on the Israeli regime, specifically on Netanyahu, to push for the meeting and attempt to reach a deal in the coming weeks. Americans and other mediators are striving to finalize an exchange agreement and a temporary ceasefire before the onset of the holy month of Ramadan in about 2 weeks. They believe that the continued fighting during the fasting month, along with the anticipated restrictions imposed on Palestinians in the West Bank and the occupied territories regarding access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, would constitute the perfect recipe for significant and comprehensive escalation within occupied Palestine as a whole, and even in the region, given that the holy month of Ramadan has typically witnessed clear security escalations in recent years. It has now become clear that the Israeli occupation seeks to close the file of captives in order to resume its field operations, relieved from the pressure of this issue, which burdens the Israeli entity decision maker and does not grant him wide maneuvering margins, whether in combat or at the negotiating table. However, on the other hand, Hamas realizes that this issue is one of the most influential factors on the Israeli entity leadership and its performance in the war, which means that Hamas will not rush to abandon it unless what it gets in return is no less than an agreement on a ceasefire. However, Netanyahu remains adamant against any formula that includes a long-term truce or a temporary cessation of hostilities for long months, as it seems that he has not yet made a real decision whether or not to invade Rafah. In related context, Egyptian sources informed the Wall Street Journal that Hamas is ready to agree to the Israeli occupation's release of 3,000 Palestinian detainees during the exchange deal. But the Zionist soldiers' captives will remain with the Palestinian resistance until a permanent agreement is reached for a comprehensive ceasefire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. It seems that the decision regarding the Rafah operation is still pending, not only due to field-related reasons, as the attack on Rafah requires different and more complicated preparations than what happened in other areas, but also because the situation there is contingent upon the positions of other parties in the war, whether they are partners to Zionist Israel or maybe mediators who at this stage refuse any attack on the city of Rafah and prefer a negotiated path to end the fighting, albeit under different names, through a relatively improved prisoner swap deal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, political analyst and lawyer, expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Omar. Now, as talks are underway in Paris, and possibly as Reuters said the other day that they might continue in Qatar, does the Israeli regime really seek to maybe end his captives' file where the pressure would be released from there and then continue his military campaign inside of Gaza with more intensity? Or is it really a very tense situation internally for Netanyahu that the Zionist entity has to be pushed into stopping this aggression, this genocidal aggression against Gaza?
Yes, well, now for more than 140 days, the genocide in Gaza is ongoing. The Israeli army has been killing people constantly since more than 140 days, using more than 60,000 tons of explosives and bombs thrown at an area that is not much larger than 360 square kilometers, where 2 million people are squeezed in this area, and now they're squeezed even more in a 50 square kilometer zone near Rafah, near the Egyptian border, where the Netanyahu and the Israelis are threatening, and they are bombing. They are bombing Rafah. Last night they bombed Rafah. They killed. Every day they're killing around 100, 150 civilians in the Rafah area. They want to do a full invasion there. And, well, they're using this in the negotiations. And that's so unethical. You know, you don't go to a negotiations and threaten people, threaten civilians with massacres in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. This is a total outrage. I mean, this is what Netanyahu's government has been doing. They've been putting on the table, you know, they want to win time, so they want to delay these negotiations as much as possible while they spill the blood of innocent civilians in Rafah and continue to destroy every possible means of life in Gaza and in Rafah more specifically now. This is outrageous. I mean, the negotiations were supposed to be over four different areas. First, the exchange of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. Second, the ceasefire, cessation of hostilities and bombing of civilian infrastructure, civilian hospitals, everything that has to do with life in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And fourth, the removal, the withdrawal of the Israeli army from the northern part and from parts of Gaza so people can return home. you know, and you know, and there is no way that the Palestinians will accept that the Israelis create buffer zones. In fact, the Americans, even the Americans, said that they will not accept the buffer zone issue. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is the return of the people to their homes and the start of the reconstruction. Where is all that in the negotiations? They only want the hostages, the prisoner exchange. For the prisoner exchange, okay, the Palestinians were ready to actually offer, saying, okay, fine, we will accept. We will accept to discuss the actual swap of one Israeli to ten Palestinians. Detainees. However, there is no agreement over the names. Because the Palestinians, you know, have in mind a list of names of people that Netanyahu is not ready to actually release and exchange. Mm-hmm. And that is also a serious obstacle.
This is what I want to discuss with you.
The biggest obstacle, I have to tell you, Marwa, the biggest obstacle is the issue of ceasefire and permanent ceasefire. Because every time there was a deal, and in the previous time when there was the exchange of prisoners, the Israelis intensified the bombardment and intensified the arrests of innocent Palestinians. So what is this exchange about? If every time we do the exchange, the Israeli army goes into the West Bank and in Gaza and arrests thousands
of people, definitely. But because I want to discuss with you the requests by the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, who said that they are ready to exchange the captives, the Israeli captives they have, with 3,000 Palestinian detainees from Israeli entity prisons. But and they want to keep the soldier captives with them in order to ensure that the ceasefire will happen. Now, whether or not this happens, that's not what we want to discuss. In the event it actually happens, let's say it does actually happen, what kind of proof does the Palestinian side have that the Zionist entity won't just start a new unforeseeable attack against residents' areas in Gaza?
Now, the massacre and the genocide, the Israeli genocide in Gaza has been going on now for more than 5 months. So let's go back to the beginning, when Hamas actually, from the beginning, and there's nothing new, they said all of the prisoners for all of the prisoners, you know, a swapping deal. That was the offer. The Israelis refused this offer. Okay, so we went to the exchange of the actual civilians and people who were guests, as Hamas called them, and there was this exchange, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and there was this operation in the past. Today, what Hamas is saying, okay, there is on the table a proposition that a ratio of 1 to 10, one Israeli for every 10, but that only applies for 35 of the prisoners, not of the 135. If there would be a general deal for the full number of prisoners, I think that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have said before that they are ready for this exchange. Mm-hmm. All of the prisoners in the Israeli concentration camps and prisons, for all of the prisoners that are the captives of Hamas and the resistance and the Islamic Jihad.
That
could be a deal. But what guarantees? Of course, there are no guarantees.
Definitely.
There are no guarantees. But if Hamas gets this deal, it's a big victory. It's an important victory. But the Israelis should know that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad did this proposal from the beginning. It is Netanyahu who made them go more into war and do more bloodshed and more massacres and more destruction and more complicating issues and complicating any path towards the minimum agreement that would stop this genocide.
Definitely, because to be honest with you, Dr. Nashebe, the Zionist entity propaganda concerning the grand invasion of Rafah has been severe for the past month at least, but especially for the past 2 weeks. But let's say Netanyahu actually achieves what he wants from any upcoming peace talk or any upcoming negotiating talk, let's say, an agreement that might see the withdrawal of the captives of the Zionist entity.
But excuse me to interrupt you. I have to say that I think that, you know, the media, the Israeli media, and the talk about Rafah is blackmailing. It's to blackmail the Americans.
But
and the
issue,
community.
You say it's to blackmail the Americans, but if what Netanyahu wants happens, will he suffice with what he has done so far in Gaza, or has the decision to invade Rafah been taken?
I think that Netanyahu has the whole will to actually destroy what's left and kill what's left of the innocent civilians that are trapped in Rafah. However, and he knows that the Americans don't want him to do that, so he keeps talking about this in order to blackmail and to put more pressure on the international community and find justifications. And he thinks, and he said it, in fact, he said that the more we threaten with blood, the blood of children and the blood of, and that would improve the actual stance of the Israelis on the negotiating table, as we said in the beginning. And that's completely unethical and unacceptable in any negotiation process. You don't threaten with the blood of women and children and hospitals in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. Mm-hmm. That is completely against international humanitarian law.
Mm-hmm. Well, within the norms that is happening right now and within the history that we know the Zionist entity, Dr. Nashebe, no one really trusts the Zionist entity, and apparently not even their allies trust them anymore. But I want to really thank you very much for being with us this morning in Beirut. Dr. Amar Nashebe, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which you can find published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, and I do advise you to follow because it's a really very important supplement. Thank you, Dr. Nashebe, for being with us. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about Yemen, how they are adamant, Yemenis are adamant on supporting the people of Palestine, and they will not stop until the Zionist entity stops its genocidal war on Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The naval forces of Sana'a continue to flexibly execute their operations in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf of Aden, while they persist in surprising the American and British navies. Following each operation that threatens the American and British vessels, the latter navies deploy swarms of drones and warplanes to patrol the international waters to protect the vessels and destroyers from Yemeni drone attacks, then carry out attacks on areas that have been already targeted before, meaning they have no real targets there. More details in the following report.
Events and developments are rapidly unfolding at the levels of direct confrontation between Yemen on one side and the United States and its allies and proxy armies on the other. U.S. and British Navy are intentionally concealing many facts about the almost daily operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces against their ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden in support of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Although the U.S. Fifth Fleet, based in Bahrain, recently acknowledged the difficulty of confronting the Yemeni side, it did not address the strikes that targeted American ships and destroyers. Conversely, military experts in Sana'a affirm that there are escalating military operations against American and British military ships and warships. This reality has become evident to the United States, which has acknowledged facing its biggest challenge since World War II. With 7,000 American soldiers at sea experiencing fatigue and exhaustion after more than 4 months of confrontation without adequate rest or leave, they were caught off guard by the military capabilities of Sana'a, including its large stockpile of missiles and drones with advanced features capable of bypassing major defense systems and reaching the closest level in the defense system, as reported by the Financial Times, citing Lisa Franchetti, the commander of the U.S. Navy. Recently, Admiral Brad Cooper, the deputy commander of the U.S. Navy in the Middle East, admitted in an interview to CBS's 60 Minutes that their forces in the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea are operating at a combat tempo unseen since World War II. He stated that their military ships are under attack with only 9 to 15 seconds to decide to intercept missiles traveling at speeds of up to 3,000 miles per hour, acknowledging the military superiority of Yemen. The Second Truth confirming the unprecedented quagmire for the United States and a highly costly war of attrition is Cooper's admission of the U.S. Navy launching about 100 missiles from its standard land-to-air missiles, each costing about $4 million U.S. dollars, against Yemeni missiles or drones worth only thousands of dollars. This means that the United States of America spent nearly $500 million on the cost of intercepting missiles alone, not to mention the cost of airstrikes and Tomahawk missiles launched at Yemeni land, operational expenses for about 7,000 American fighters, surveillance, reconnaissance, and satellite costs with zero results, as underscored by Sayyid Abdulmalik Badreddin al-Houthi in his speech last week. Meanwhile, Yemeni strategic operations continue to escalate significantly, effectively, and tangibly breaking the backbone of the Israeli entity economy, and it seems it won't cease as long as the Palestinian blood continues to flow, and tears of children and women continue to shed. It is a commitment that has been affirmed by the Yemeni leadership, and they will continue to adhere to it until the Israeli entity genocidal war stops and water, food, and medicine are delivered to Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist and political analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, after its failure,